What in God's name are we doing?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
We're like children. We're not men.
No, we're not. We're not men.
Ideals of manhood differ across time and culture.
So why is it there's any one thing it means to be a man?
We're pathetic, you know that?
Yeah, like I don't know that I'm pathetic.
Should men always have to be masculine?
A doctor looks at a baby, decides it's a boy, and saddles it with a whole lifetime of expectations.
I'm not a baby, I'm a man. I am an anchor man.
Why can't we have feminism and men's rights?
I am a man, more sinned against than sinning.
Everyone should have grievances about the way they're treated on the basis of gender, men included.
Our guest is Robin Denbrough from Yale University.
What is masculinity?
I'm a man, Peter. I've got an ocean of testosterone flowing through my veins.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Does masculinity need a makeover for the 21st century?
Should your gender matter to who you are as a person?
Well, I think there's just one thing it means to be a man.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Blakey Vermeul, sitting in for Josh Landy. We're coming to you from our respective living rooms via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Blakey teaches in the Philosophy and Literature program. Thanks for stepping in to co-host with me today, Blakey.
My pleasure. Today we're asking, what is masculinity?
Well, it's a tool of the patriarchy. We should get rid of it.
Oh, come on. What have you got against men?
Nothing. Some of my best friends are men. What I'm against is narrow expectations. Like, why should men have to be strong or aggressive or bad at showing their feelings?
Masculinity doesn't have to be about narrow expectations. Men can be caring fathers or shy introverts or figure skaters, whatever they want to be. And you know what? None of that makes them any less masculine.
So you're saying that anything a man does is masculine by definition?
Well, isn't that better than trying to shove people into little pink or blue boxes?
Sure, maybe it's better, but at that point, why worry about gender at all? Why not focus on what we have in common as human beings?
A lot of people really care about being men, and they want to be good at it. Strong, honest, self-sacrificing.
Unfeeling, domineering, violent. Look, Blakey, you have to admit that some of those stereotypes are really messed up.
Sure, we should get rid of negative stereotypes, but aren't there plenty of positive things about masculinity? Men are supposed to be straightforward and say what they mean.
Well, yeah, everyone should be straightforward and say what they mean, not just one gender.
Okay, but upper body strength, very white voices, and luscious beards are specific to men.
Hey, there are women with beards too.
Look, I'm not denying a woman's right to grow facial hair, but most people with beards are men, and I say it's a good thing to rock your manly facial hair.
Sure, sure, there's nothing wrong with it, but there's nothing especially right about it either. I mean, some men look good with beards, some men don't. Why should we have to lump them together under one image of masculinity?
We could have lots of masculinities, plural, that way people could choose whichever one suited them.
What does that even mean?
Well, not every man has to be a heroic firefighter. They can be stay-at-home dads or older gay men who lead neighborhood cleanups or nurses who comfort the sick and the dying.
Oh, gosh. Now men have to live up to society's ideal of what a good male nurse is, too. You're just introducing more stereotypes. I mean, how does that help?
Great question. One we can put to our guest, Robin Denbrough from Yale University, who's writing a book called Real Men on Top, The Metaphysics of Patriarchy. We'll talk to them in just a little bit.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Ariella Markowitz, to talk to some people who are helping men rethink their relationship to masculinity. And a quick warning, this story does discuss sexual assault and domestic violence. Listener discretion is advised.
Colin Adamo is a grad student studying clinical psychology. He also educates kids about sex. When he first started going to classrooms and talking to students, he noticed he was usually the only cis male sex ed teacher.
There was something that I could provide to the young men in the classroom that maybe others couldn't. Validation of their experience, to be like, I know where you're coming from. And a lot of the materials that we produce don't often feel like they really take into account the perspective of young men or like all the cultural factors that they have to navigate that are really challenging.
Stereotypes like having to be straight and mistreating women to be a real man put a lot of pressure on teenagers to engage in risky or abusive behavior, but they're rarely acknowledged in health curriculums or even in conversations at home. So Colin says that it's really powerful to be upfront about masculinity.
Being sexually transmitted infections, intimate partner violence, sexual assault, and homophobic bullying, all these issues that we've been trying to address for decades, they all involve young men, and yet they never address young men directly. You know, there's some problems around these other issues, but really if we help young men embody more transformative masculinities, like, a lot of these other problems will be solved inherently.
Transformative masculinity. It isn't a new idea. When second wave feminists were fighting for equity, a lot of them included men in their vision for gender revolution. This is Betty Friedan in 1964, speaking about how a lot of men began challenging their traditional roles.
Kill bears when there are no bears to kill, and napalm all the children in Vietnam and Cambodia to prove that I'm a man, you know, and be dominant and superior to everyone concerned, and never show any softness. Well, these boys that are wearing their hair long are saying no.
But part of the reason transformative masculinity never became mainstream is because of a patriarchal culture of abuse and silence. And that has real consequences. A disproportionate number of men are in prison, show symptoms of depression, and commit suicide every year. Young men are often getting a very direct and brutal education about being a man.
My dad used to hold me down while I twisted my arm back. The pain would be piercing. He would keep twisting until it would almost break, and he would say, "That doesn't hurt! Quit complaining! Be a man!"
That's Galen Silvestri. He's sharing stories about his past at a live event hosted by the Men's Story Project. He grew up being told, "Don't show vulnerability or pain. Physically hurt others before they hurt you." He suffered years of abuse and also abused others. And after years of therapy and community support, he was able to change.
It is time for men to tell their stories, for men to tell the truth about being men and begin the healing process, because there is no need for this pain. This legacy must not continue.
Josie Lehrer, a health researcher, founded the Men's Story Project 14 years ago after leading studies on adolescent sexual health and facilitating an HIV support group.
Back in 2008, there was very little by way of public dialogue on how it is that boys and men are taught, raised, pressured, socialized to be quote-unquote men.
Lehrer says storytelling encourages men to let go of their suffering that's tied to the fear of not being man enough. She believes men need spaces for solidarity and compassion, the freedom to show that being a man can mean anything you want it to be, whether it falls inside traditional gender roles or not.
I think there are as many ways to be a male-identifying human being as there are male-identifying human beings in the world. If a particular guy wants to play sports and, you know, whatever, do things that, you know, eat really huge cheeseburger. Well, I don't know if I would support the eating huge cheeseburgers. But anyway, the point is, you know, if he wants to do some things that have been stereotypically called masculine because they really love those things and it's not hurting anybody, cool. You know, I don't have any issue with that. My only concern as a public health person and as a human in the world is about supporting people in living lives of health, equity, and self-expression.
This kind of philosophy isn't telling men they're not allowed to be masculine. On the contrary, it's affirming that anyone can be a man. There are infinite ways to be one, and that healthy versions of masculinity support health and equality for all people. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Ariella Markowitz.
Thanks for that very thoughtful report, Ariella. You can learn more about the Men's Story Project at mensstoryproject.org. I'm Ray Briggs, and with me today is my Stanford colleague, Blake Gavermuel. And today we're asking, what is masculinity?
We're joined now by Robin Dembroff. They are a professor of philosophy at Yale University. They're the author of Real Talk on the Metaphysics of Gender and a forthcoming book, Real Men on Top, The Metaphysics of Patriarchy. Robin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Robin, what first got you interested in writing about gender?
Oh, I mean, I was someone who was raised as a girl, but who also had a lot of deep affinity and interest in aspects of what is considered masculinity. And so as someone who occupied that position, I was very aware at a young age of the ways that gender both binds us and polices us to either masculinity or femininity, and about the arbitrariness of that binding and the way that it takes a real psychological toll on people.
Robin, at the beginning of the show, Ray argued that we should do away with the concept of masculinity, and I disagreed. But you think there's a legitimate critique against the concept of masculinity. Tell us about that.
Yeah, when I was listening to your exchange, one thing that struck me was that it seemed like Ray was talking about the concept of masculinity, and you were talking a lot about the features that get coded as masculine. And while I totally agree that there's lots of features that get coded as masculine that are really worthwhile and important and virtuous features, that's different than, in my view, from the concept of masculinity, which has to do with being unlike women and being the way that a man is seen as what the way that a man ought to be or must to be. And I think that any kind of idea of how someone ought or must be simply on the basis of whether they're male or female is a constrictive way of treating people that we should get rid of.
So, Robin, you've said that your critique differs from the critiques of some other feminists. Can you say more about how it's different from standard critiques?
The main way it differs is with respect to the connection between masculinity and maleness, on my view. So lots of people have made the point that masculinity is seen as how men ought to be, and that there are many ways in which being subject to these norms about how you ought to be, even independently of the points that you were making about how those ways are often really destructive, like violence, that's limiting for people. But I think in addition to that, on my view, there is a dominant idea or very popular idea that masculinity has a really close tie to maleness itself, such that maleness is seen as the explanation for masculinity. It's the essence of being a man that both explains how men must be, or if they aren't that way, how they ought to be. And I think seeing that really close connection between maleness and masculinity clues us in to how masculinity is both something that is perpetuating across various times and cultures, even as those particular norms change, as well as how the enforcement of masculinity can be really destructive to people's lives.
So this is interesting to me, both because you are a person who was sort of raised as with female expectations, and also because who identifies with masculinity, and also because I've read sort of books like Female Masculinity by Jack Halberstam or Stone Butch Blues by Leslie Feinberg that are about masculine women. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's room for people who were either assigned women or consider themselves women now to be masculine in the concept of masculinity?
I think that there's room to be a deviant while being seen as female. And one way of being deviant is by taking on different traits or features or behaviors that are coded as masculine. And we can call that masculinity. We can say that that person is a masculine woman or a masculine female person. But I think that's different than making this point about the concept of masculinity. So Halberstam thinks that masculinity can come apart from maleness, and I completely disagree with that.
Can you say why you disagree with that?
Yeah, it's because I think that masculinity as a concept is defined in opposition to femininity. And so as a concept, it's tied in this way that I mentioned before. It's tied to maleness, as maleness is being the essence of manhood. That means that someone must and ought be a certain way. And those must and ought ways that you should be, those are masculinity. And so I think that if we got to the point where whether your body was seen as a male body or female body made no difference to your access to masculinity, that would be a world in which the concept of masculinity just didn't exist anymore.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about masculinity with Robin Dembroff from Yale University.
Is the concept of masculinity hurting women and men? Should we reshape our ideals or abandon them altogether? Does it even make sense to lump all men into a single category?
Tough guys, soft boys, and people beyond the binary. Along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. From the playboys to the gay boys, we could all benefit from talking more about gender. I'm Ray Briggs. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Blakey Vermeule, sitting in for Josh Landy, and we're thinking about masculinity with Robin Dembroff from Yale University.
We're pre-recording this episode from our respective homes, and we can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Robin, we've been critiquing the concept of masculinity, but some men have grievances about how society treats them. What are some of those grievances?
Yeah, I mean, everyone should have grievances about the way they're treated on the basis of gender, men included. Masculinity, as I say in my book, is a small steel reinforced cage. It puts very extreme expectations on people that are enforced often with things like violence. So I think men are totally right that they are often, you know, sent to war and treated, their lives are treated like fodder for economic interests. They are often subject, especially if they're men of color, to police brutality and incarceration. They have a lot of extreme societal expectations put on them in terms of the way that they ought to interact with other people and the kinds of aggression that they're expected to show and then, you know, punished for showing or not showing, often, again, dependent on their race or various economic status. So, I mean, I think that men are absolutely right to have grievances about masculinity.
So it occurs to me that men are kind of both advantaged and disadvantaged by sexism, which is kind of puzzling. I'm wondering if you can help me make sense of this idea that seems true.
Yeah, so on my view, whether someone is advantaged or disadvantaged on the basis of gender has to do with the relation that they stand in to cultural ideals of manhood and womanhood. But what's really important about those cultural ideals is that those ideals build in things like race and class and disability, such that if you're a man of color, or if you're a disabled man, or you're a gay man, the way you are measured up against those ideals, and so also the way you are treated in light of that measuring up, is going to vary a lot. And so if you're seen as falling short of those ideals, you're often going to be hugely disadvantaged on the basis of standing in that relation to those ideals of manhood.
So what about, so you've mentioned the fact that men are disproportionately sent to war and subject to various kinds of state violence, especially if they're men of color. How do you account for the fact that so many of them end up being CEOs of Fortune 500 companies or presidents of universities or presidents of their countries?
Yeah, I think, again, here it's really important to look at what those cultural ideals of manhood are, because it's not disabled men of color or gay men who are becoming presidents and CEOs. And typically, I mean, of course, there are certain exceptions, but I think the exceptions prove the rule here. The men who tend to be the ones who accrue the most power are the ones who are most benefited by those ideals of manhood.
Yeah, I want to take a little bit of issue with Blakey's suggestion that many men are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies or presidents of universities, just because there aren't that many slots for anybody there.
Right.
So we have an email from Terry in Emory, Wisconsin, that seems relevant here. So Terry writes, men have been thrown into a mill of feminism, climate change, BIPOC issues, that's Black and Indigenous people of color, LGBT issues, all challenging the status quo. It's about time that we addressed men's evolving place and role in our cultures. Perhaps, writes Terry, we will move toward focusing on ourselves as humans instead of men and women. So, Robin, comments?
Well, I think there's the question of whether that's actually happening or whether it would be a good thing to happen. I totally agree that it would be great if we could be, as this non-binary person said in an interview in the Washington Post, just people wearing people clothes. I would love to just be a person wearing people clothes in the world and not have my body constantly being scrutinized for people to guess what my genitals are and then make evaluations of what I'm wearing and how I'm walking and how I'm talking and everything else on the basis of that scrutinization. Scrutinization is not a word. But I also think that one thing to keep in mind about masculinity and femininity is that they're super wily and they're dynamic. They change over time in response to various kinds of social and economic pressures. So while it often might seem that masculinity is in a kind of acute crisis and that has happened over and over and over again, what you see throughout the history of masculinity is that when it reaches this kind of boiling point of having a lot of pressure put on the current ideals of manhood, whatever those might be, the ideals just shift in order to maintain the connection between power and manhood.
So isn't it the case that masculinity and femininity evolve together in lockstep? And they're both sort of equally wily. Would you say that, or would you
absolutely
say that masculinity has more wiliness to it, or femininity has more wiliness to it?
No, again, I think it's a part of my view, and this is a view that I think is shared among many people who work on both masculinity and femininity, is that they're defined in opposition to each other. So when something becomes coded as feminine, had previously was coded as masculine, say wearing pants, what you often see is that either that thing becomes gender neutral, like wearing jeans, it's not masculine or feminine, it's just gender neutral, or you get a division within that thing. So now there's men's pants and women's pants, but it's not the case that you ever find something that's both an aspect of masculinity and an aspect of femininity, and that's because they're defined in opposition.
So Robin, sometimes I have found it tempting, I think a lot of people I know have found it tempting, to try and fight sexism by acting against stereotypes. So if you're a man, like, don't be afraid to wear frilly things, or like be really involved in your kids' lives, which you should probably be doing anyway. But the thing that you just said, that masculinity and femininity are very wily, suggests that might not be a very effective strategy. Because won't stereotypes of masculinity and femininity just adapt to accommodate people trying to act against them?
Yes, I think that they do adapt. And so what's really important is that those behavioral changes be accompanied by an insistence that it's not a new version of masculinity, but it's rather just being a person. And this is why I take a lot of issue with what we're seeing now as quote unquote feminist marketing that's promoting a narrative of like the Nike ads or the P&G ads of run like a girl or do these things like a girl, where the message is something like, there's still a way that there is to do things like a girl. It's just that way is as good as doing things like a man. But the problem with doing that is that you still are upholding cultural ideals of manhood and womanhood. And even if we reach a point where manhood and womanhood are equally valued, those ideals of manhood and womanhood are still going to have things like race and sexuality and class and disability built into them. So that, yes, maybe Amy Coney Barrett can sit on the Supreme Court and certain white, cis, heterosexual, non-disabled women can have equal power with their male counterparts, but there's still going to be a lot of men and women who are disadvantaged and pushed to the bottom of the social ladder as a result of upholding these ideals.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about masculinity with Robin Dembroff from Yale University. And Robin, we've got another email from a listener. So Matt in San Francisco writes, "Growing up, I found the behavioral attributes of gender to be hit and miss. Some of my attributes fit stereotypical masculine roles, and others were more aligned to feminine roles. I was fine with who I was and thought the problem was the dumb gender visions. How about viewing the problem not being the wrong version of masculinity, that we have a vision of masculinity versus a bunch of human attributes that one can select from and reflect who we are? Why can't we all be potato heads?" So that sounds a lot like what you're saying.
Yeah, I definitely think that one of the ways that masculinity and femininity are constructed, particularly when they're in opposition to each other, right, is that you get important pro-social traits in both what's stereotypically masculine and what's stereotypically feminine. And as a result of the policing of masculinity and femininity, you only get access to a non-disparaged subset of those pro-social traits. And that's just a way of really constraining and reducing people in a way that isn't helpful to anyone psychologically, even if certain people economically and politically benefit from it.
I'm curious, you used the word ideals several times in this conversation, and I'm curious what you would say to people who do hold masculinity as an ideal or femininity as an ideal. I mean, for some people, these are not simply constraining roles, but ideals to strive for. How do you talk to people who hold ideals of gender?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of people, right? And I think that it's important to think about what you're saying and saying that there is an ideal of masculinity or a femininity, because what that's really saying is that there's an ideal way for people who are born with a penis to be, or people who are born with a vagina to be, which, you know, you are the one that has to give a good story about why that's not completely arbitrary. Why should just a biological feature of a body when it's born set up this huge, massive, all-encompassing set of expectations for how that person ought to be? And, you know, historically and still, I think that's so wrapped up in heteronormativity that when we really start looking at where those ideals come from and why they're so policed, we can see that they go through and through all the way down with ideals that have to do with idea of the complementariness of maleness and femaleness, where we see the world as divided into two sets of social roles that people are destined to fulfill, or if they don't fulfill them, we get to punish them for not fulfilling.
So I can imagine somebody objecting here. Say you might have like a masculine gay man or a femme lesbian saying, well, I'm masculine or feminine, depending on which they are, but I'm not invested in heteronormativity, because I'm not even invested in heterosexuality. I'm not straight. Do you think that, like, what would you say to that objection?
Yeah, here I want to go back to my definition of masculinity as cultural ideals of how men must or ought to be, and ditto for femininity of how females must or ought to be. Because you can have a masculine, say, presentation, or, you know, preferences, or ones that are feminine presentation and so on, but that's going to be only a subset of the things that within our society is deemed to be the things that men must or ought to be, or women must or ought to be. And I think it's undeniable that still in our culture, being solely attracted to cisgender women is something that men are considered either biologically destined for, or if they fall short of that, it's how they ought to be and they get to be punished for it. And ditto with being solely attracted to cisgender men for women.
Right. So I wonder, so this is an alternative to getting rid of gender roles that some people have defended. So another thing you could do is you could broaden them to the point of being almost contentless. So you say, to be masculine is to be anything that a man does or wants, rather than an ideal of what men should be. So we just broaden the ideal until it's got no content anymore. And similarly for femininity, it's whatever a woman does or wants to do is feminine. That seems like a way of getting rid of stereotypes. Do you think that it would be adequate?
I don't think it's possible. But I think there's a number of things to say about it. Okay. So if you actually just treated this as a descriptive sociological endeavor, where we were going to take all the people that we code as men, and we're just going to talk about all the features that they have, and all of those things count as masculinity, that thing is going to be, I mean, I think ideals of masculinity are already internally contradictory, but that list is going to be hugely inconsistent. It's going to be all over the place. It's going to be massively overlapping with the same set of descriptive features that women have. And so a totally non-normative sense of masculinity is one that does no explanatory work. It's kind of unclear what the point would be of having such a concept. But I think there's an even deeper issue here, which is, what are people assuming that maleness and femaleness are when they go about the world looking for how males and females are? And here again, I think we find normativity coming back into the picture, because we live in a society where just by virtue of being human, you are thought to be someone who must or ought to be either male or female. And people who have bodies who don't fit that binary are punished, they are marginalized, and sometimes their bodies at birth are even surgically changed to make sure they fit one of those ideals. So I think even if you take this descriptive approach to what masculinity or femininity is, you're still building in normativity at the level of maleness and femaleness.
So we have an email from Carl in Portland that I think actually goes directly to this question about normativity and punishment. So Carl asks, I don't see how we can reach a real goal for us all as equals in our gender groups when some or most folks remain oppressed, not free from stereotyping because of what they do or present to the world. If a man likes to knit or crochet, then he is not the less of a man for that preference. Similarly, if a woman prefers football or wrestling as her sport, why would or should she be designated as less feminine in other circles? It's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer again has to do with power. Who are these ideals serving? And again, when I think you look at the content of these ideals and how they are valued in relation to each other, you find that both the ideals of manhood and of womanhood are thoroughly intersectional. So that means they're shaped by things, again, like race and sexuality and disability. And also manhood as an ideal is valued over and above womanhood. And so no matter how you match up to the ideals of womanhood, if you're seen as female, you're going to be devalued. And if you're a man who's seen as falling short of the ideals of manhood, you're going to be devalued. And what that means is that there's a small subset of people in our society who gain the most and are disadvantaged the least by virtue of their relation to these ideals. And I think they're the ones with a lot of power, and they're really invested in maintaining the system.
So Robin, you've mentioned a couple of times that our ideals of masculinity and femininity are sort of not just gendered, they're also sort of inflected with like race and ableism. Can you give some more concrete examples of how that works?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is I don't think there's any such thing as just gender. I think that there is no ontological, there's no distinction in the world between gender and things like race and class and disability. But we can just, you know, just to give some really obvious examples, think about the ideals of masculinity that you mentioned earlier in the show about being strong and athletic. Those are really ableist ideals, as are the ones that have to do with, say, think about things for like paying for dates. That's a lot of classes built into that. But in addition to the ideals being intersectional at the level of the content, they're also intersectional at the level of enforcement. So if a Black man and a white man are accused of the same act of violence, the white man is likely to have his violence or accusation of violence dismissed as boys will be boys. That's inevitable for him given the fact that he's male. Whereas the Black man is going to receive often very different treatment and perhaps be subject to incarceration or other forms of violence or even violence against his community as a result of that accusation. So we have to look at both what the ideals are and also how they are played out in the world in terms of how people police men on the basis of those ideals.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're asking, what is masculinity? With Robin Dembroff from Yale University.
What does positive masculinity look like in the 21st century? How can we foster collaboration between men, women, and everybody else? Will we ever achieve gender justice?
Masculinities for the modern era. Plus, a discussion with host emeritus John Perry, prompted by a question from one of our listeners. When Philosophy Talk continues. Gets to decide what a real man is, who the real men are. I'm Ray Briggs, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Blake Vermeule. Our guest is Robin Dembroff from Yale, and we're asking, what is masculinity?
So we've got an email, Robin, from our listener, Henry, who's actually the person who proposed this show topic. And Henry asked about a book called Age of Anger, which argues that the Enlightenment triggered a system of war of all against all, hence the anger. He says his concern is that the results of this system in the areas of economic instability and cultural change has caused an anxiety in many men about being emasculated, and that such anxiety leads to an obsession with a traditional view of masculinity, like Mussolini or Trump, emphasizing violence, always winning, total autonomy, freedom to do anything, and no need for concern about the welfare of losers. He says he hopes that a serious examination of the true nature of manhood will attenuate this unhealthy anxiety and reduce the seduction of unrestrained economic activity, violence, efforts toward political domination, racial supremacy, and gender injustice. So, Robin, what do you think of that?
Oh, there's a lot there. I mean, I think the phrase that I would pick up on is the phrase, the true nature of manhood.
Yeah.
And I would want to know, what is there, or is it simply a vanishing point? When we look at the concept of manhood, does it disappear into just the connection between ideals of the male body and ideals of masculinity? Because I think there's actually no there. And I think seeing that can be really helpful at attenuating the sort of violence and freedom to harm others and lack of empathy that it seems like Henry is pointing us to.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up a little bit about some of the anxiety that he's writing about. So if I've got you right on your view, this anxiety is partly the result of thinking that masculinity has to have a true nature in the first place. Have I got that right?
Yeah.
So, Robin, we sometimes like to make our guests czar for the day, but in your case, we're going to make you king among men with the power to issue any edict you like. What's the first thing you would do as king to create more gender equality in the world?
That is a difficult question, mostly because, as I mentioned before, I think that masculinity and femininity and the inequality that exists between manhood and womanhood are adaptive. They change in response to pressure. And so because of that, I think that there is nothing any given individual could do that would undo the inequality in our society. It's going to take a huge collaboration between different groups that understand that they have a common basis of solidarity and the fact that they are all treated badly on the basis of gender. But that said, I think that maybe the one thing that a certain individual with a lot of power could do, and so I guess it would be the thing that I would do, is undo the gendering that exists within formal institutions. So undo things like having automatic birth certificates that gender people on the basis of a binary, undo things like having different rules for men and women across policing, across incarceration, across schooling. And I think that that's something that would have to, even as czar in the way that you point to, it would have to be done gradually, right? Because if we did that suddenly, it might have a lot of negative impact. But I think setting up a kind of plan for phasing out the gendering of our formal institutions, and particularly the state, would be the thing that I would focus on.
Yeah, so one thing I have noticed about documentation and traveling is that my legal state gender marker has to have one of two letters on it to mark my gender. And also, I think that some people, but not everybody knows this, if you fly, not that anybody is flying these days, but if post-pandemic you fly and you walk through one of those TSA x-ray machines, there are two buttons that the TSA agent can push, depending on whether they think you're a man or a woman. And then they interpret the body scan differently.
Color-coded buttons.
Yep, a pink one and a blue one. I'm not sure I have a question about that, but it's just such a striking tidbit, and I'm amazed that like it's not more widely known.
Yeah, I think once you start paying attention to the way that gender shows up in formal institutions. I mean, obviously it shows up in informal institutions like our families and friendships and social groups everywhere, but it really also shows up in informal institutions. And once you start looking for it, you'll see it everywhere.
So I'm imagining, you said some things about gradual change. So I'm imagining that one kind of objection that you might have to degendering sort of all of your formal institutions is a similar kind of objection to the one you might have against race blindness, yeah, where there's a lot of existing gender injustice in the world. And some formal institutions include things like scholarships for women to study in fields where women are underrepresented. And so degendering your institutions would mean getting rid of those things. And it's sort of hard to know how to get from here to a place where gender really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's because as long as those ideals are enforced and they're seen as things that people must or ought to be simply on the basis of their perceived genitalia at birth, they're going to create systemic inequality. So you have to make an intervention at the level of having these things that mark people as either male or female and therefore have this set of things that they must or ought to be. And it's really hard to do that without also, as you said, harming some of the attempts to undermine the existing inequality. So this is kind of, and that's one of the things also in addition to adaptability that makes this system so difficult to change.
So we've been asking now about gender categories, male and female. And I might also wonder, like, what is the relationship to masculinity and femininity?
Between maleness and femaleness?
Right. So you might think, like, these are at least separable in principle. Like, you could have categories of male and female without categories of masculinity or femininity or vice versa, since people can be, like, maybe you think unmasculine men or unfeminine women or feminine men or masculine women. I'm still trying to get a handle on what exactly the relationship is between those two sets of concepts.
Yeah, great. So again, I think here it's important to think about what are we talking about when we talk about maleness and femaleness? Because the most common way of thinking about those things that people will say is that they're just talking about biological sex, where they mean something like clusters of physical features of bodies, things like chromosomes and hormone levels and gonads and genitalia. But when you actually look at how maleness and femaleness play out in the world, they're not just clusters of bodily features. The bodies that people have and the features that those bodies have vary widely. I mean, you can even have different so-called sex chromosomes across different cells of a single body. So the way that maleness and femaleness actually play out in the world, and I had mentioned this earlier, but coming back to it, is as themselves as ideals of ways that every human body must or ought to be. And when a body doesn't fit one of those two ideals sufficiently enough to be coded as male or female, then often those people are marginalized, or again, there's kind of medical and surgical interventions that are medically unnecessary, but are imposed on infants in order to make sure that their body fits one of these two ideals. And what's the reason for that? So then it brings us to the next question of why do we care so much about everybody being able to be quickly and easily seen as unambiguously male or female? And I think that has to do with masculinity and femininity. We use masculinity and femininity as the two robust lenses through which to see every single person that we interact with and ourselves, importantly, and that shape how we evaluate everyone else and how we think about what to expect from them, or how to react to their different behaviors or features. And I think we can't disentangle masculinity and femininity from femaleness and maleness, because those are themselves the created conduits or ideals that funnel people into these sets of expectations.
So I have a question about, it goes back to Henry's email. It's a question about power. Given that gender for some people is a source of worldly power, power in the world, and some people get very attached to what they take to be a kind of traditional masculinity or traditional femininity. How do you ask those people? So I'm thinking of various members of the Trump family, for instance, to give up the kind of power that's associated with extreme sort of gender self-fashioning in a very hierarchical landscape?
That's an excellent question. I think it really has to come down to creating or inducing a kind of silence, a sort of inward looking, and even a sort of existential crisis, as it were. Because if you look at the statistics, cis straight white men are overrepresented in things like violent deaths, drug abuse, suicide, and other very bad health outcomes. They're not happy. So I think it's important here to distinguish between power and well-being. And the fact is that gender doesn't contribute to anyone's well-being, even those, and perhaps in some ways, even especially those to whom it gives a lot of power. So I think the only way to get people who are really attached to the power that comes from gender to give up on that attachment is to shift their focus away from power to think about what it means for them to be flourishing as human beings.
Robin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Our guest has been Robin Dembroff, who's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of Real Talk on the Metaphysics of Gender. And thank you, Blakey, for co-hosting with me today.
Thank you, Ray. It has been a real pleasure.
We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
In fact, let's check in with our host emeritus, John Perry, to see if he can help us with a question related to recent events here in the U.S. from a listener in our community of thinkers.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood.
John, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here.
So David asks, as a philosopher myself, it would arouse interest to have trained philosophers discussing some of the major issues online, such as what constitutes incitement.
Yes, I checked my Oxford English. No, actually, I didn't. I checked my Wikipedia dictionary. It says
it's more contemporary.
To incite is to encourage or stir up violent or unlawful behavior. And violent or unlawful is in parentheses. I suppose you could incite someone to do something good. But what do you think, Ray? I mean, does the First Amendment, free speech, does that mean federal government can't stop you from inciting a riot?
So it turns out that the Supreme Court has had a lot of things to say about that over the years. So I guess one major landmark case is Brandenburg versus Ohio in 1969. This is where the Ku Klux Klan led a rally and made a bunch of inflammatory speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And then got arrested and fined and sentenced to prison time. And the Supreme Court said this was actually the wrong decision. This was unconstitutional. Because what they did actually didn't count as incitement. Like, we can agree that it's morally bad, but yeah, it is protected speech.
Because I've heard of the Brandenburg test. Right?
Yes, that's from
that must be where he came up with that, right?
Yeah, that's right. In order to count as the illegal kind of incitement, you have to have intent to speak. So you have to be trying to address a crowd. So if I just like tell a crowd that they should go commit satanic murders, that doesn't necessarily count as incitement, even if I do it on purpose. Because it also has to be like probable that the crowd would listen to me.
Yeah, that's where the phrase clear and present danger comes from, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So there has to be both imminence of lawlessness and likelihood of lawlessness.
So if KALW were to cancel Philosophy Talk,
and oh gosh.
we had a protest, and I say, this is terrible, you ought to burn the place down. and then they burn the place down, I could plead. Well, that wasn't at all probable. No one would have guessed that bunch of nerds would burn the place down. So yep. I should be innocent by that test, right?
Right. And also, if you told me that a bunch of nerds ought to burn the place down, and like you knew that there were fire-starting nerds outside waiting to burn the place down, but you didn't intend for them to hear it, also wouldn't be incitement. So you couldn't get constitutionally punished for that.
But if I went outside and all the Philosophy Talk protesters were wearing T-shirts that said Philosophy Talk owns KLW, or you know, then there probably would be a clear and present danger.
Yeah. So I think that there is like a question also about what constitutes telling somebody to commit violence, especially if you're speaking in kind of vague or roundabout ways.
That would be fun to talk about, because we could get into the philosophy of language and Austin's distinction between locutionary, illocutionary, and perlocutionary acts.
Wait, so what's that?
Well, suppose I say, burn it down. Well, I've committed a locutionary act. I've used English with its ordinary meaning and thereby expressed a proposition. And the illocutionary act is what you do in expressing the proposition. Suppose I say, please burn it down. That would be a request. That's what you do by performing a locutionary act, usually. And the perlocutionary act is what you actually achieve. So if they go burn it down, that would be my perlocutionary act.
So how does this help us understand incitement? If somebody asks me, what did John Perry say that we should do to KALW? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, burn it down, because that's what you said. And then people burn it down because they think that I'm an authority. Like, is that really on me?
Well, I don't know. Ask my defense lawyer.
As long as I don't have to ask my defense lawyer.
Yeah. So it does sound like the Brandenburg test in Austinian lingo is the perlocutionary act has to be a riot or something unlawful. Can't just be the locutionary act or even the illocutionary act. By the way, listeners, there's no sign that KALW intends to.
Please don't burn it down. Please don't burn it down, guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much, David, for writing in with your question.
Yes, thank you, David.
And thank you, John, for joining us.
Thanks to all of you for allowing me back in.
If you've got a conundrum that's got you in a bind, a dilemma in your personal life that might benefit from some philosophical insight,
send it to us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org, and maybe we can think through it together.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Jr. University. Copyright 2021.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamintuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. And Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.